Colin, let me go to you first. There's certainly a broadly observed cultural stereotype that elite technical colleges like Georgia Tech are particularly high-pressure environments that extract a mental health toll on their students. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah, I don't think there's any debate there.
Well, I suppose there's another stereotype that a lot of the students who tend to go to elite technical colleges have fewer coping skills available to them to deal with such things. Is that true?
I wouldn't say necessarily fewer coping skills as compared to anyone else. I think that people have conditions that they're predisposed to before coming to college. And then once you get to an environment such as Georgia Tech, which is so high pressure, those conditions tend to emerge faster than they would at, say, your standard liberal arts college.
We asked Georgia Tech students whether they are aware of the mental health resources that are available on campus, and here's some clips of some of what they said to us.
Hi, my name is Juliana Mena. I am a second year industrial engineering major here at Georgia Tech. I actually know that there's a counseling center here on campus, but I have never really, I don't know how to access it, if I'm quite honest.
My name is Brandon. I'm a fourth year IE at Georgia Tech. I don't know a lot about them. I know we have a health center, Stamps. They're pretty good at stuff. I don't know where to go for mental health, though.
My name is Sheena Ganju, and I'm a fourth-year industrial engineer. Yeah, so there's a decent amount of quantity of things you can go to, whether it's women's health resources or mental health resources. We have a psychiatrist as well in the Stamp Student Health Center. So I think there's a decent amount.
Colin Spencer, you are a student at Georgia Tech. You are with a group that's dedicated toward raising awareness of mental health issues at Georgia Tech. As you listen to your peers and their impressions of the resources that are available on campus, what are you thinking?
Well, we've known for a long time that people's knowledge on mental health on campus is mixed. It seems sort of like you almost have to be in the know, which it shouldn't be that way. I think a big part of that is that incoming students aren't initially exposed to those resources at, say, FACET orientation. Like, for example, like they'll mention the counseling center, but the counseling center itself is located in the back corner of a building. And so no one actually knows where it is, and that causes quite a few problems.
Sure. Tim Elmore with the group Growing Leaders. To what extent are the issues that you're hearing about here at Georgia Tech representative of things that happen at college campuses all over the country?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we're hearing about this almost everywhere we go. The nationwide data is about 27% of college-age students experience some type of mental health issue. The ones we're hearing most about are anxiety disorders, eating disorders, and depression. And I totally agree with your other guest. I think that most students just aren't really paying attention when they first get oriented to the school on where the counseling center is or how often they might need to access that to just practice good emotional hygiene. You know, that we do dental hygiene and we got our academic advisors, but I'm not sure if we're really taking advantage of the help we need, at least in our day, for the volume of problems that pop up during college.
Are college students more susceptible to mental health issues than other students, other people of the same age?
This is a guess now. This is just me based on my experience. Probably so, only because of what we just noted, that you get into college and you feel the pressure to make the grade, make the team, you're striving to keep up that GPA, to get the scholarship, or to please mom and dad. There's all kinds of reasons. So my hunch is that, while it's everywhere, it's probably even more so in a high-pressure cooker like a college campus where we just feel so much like how I do here is how it's going to turn out for my career.
We're talking about the availability and the quality of mental health services on college campuses, and we're talking about it apropos of the death of Scout Schultz, a Georgia Tech student who apparently committed what they call a suicide by cop on the Tech campus recently. And going to Colin Spencer, who is with the student group, the Mental Health Student Coalition of Georgia Tech. Colin, you talked about the availability of mental health services on the Tech campus and how a lot of students aren't able to find it, don't know what's available, don't know what they can get. Once they get in, what is the quality of the services, in your opinion?
I mean, based off of my experience, I found it extremely helpful, and they helped me make a tremendous recovery from where I started. But it's also mixed, right? The Georgia Tech Counseling Center, they are there for the initial treatment of a student whenever they come and for general counseling. And for people who need long-term repetitive care, they have like a huge list, a huge database that they can point students to. But they're probably not going to be able to help with very specific things, such as eating disorders in a long-term manner, but they can treat it for, you know, a semester or two.
Let's listen to a couple other students' impressions. Here's Georgia Tech student Lauren Douglas telling us that she has a friend who had a negative experience with on-campus counseling.
I guess they didn't find it helpful, and it was like really difficult to like get a slot to talk to somebody to like get help. So I think it's just literally there's not enough like resources for the number of people who need help.
Now here's Tech student William Cuthburton saying that he had a positive experience, even though he has a friend who did not have a positive experience.
I got plugged into a support group last year. It had a really positive effect on how I was feeling about certain things. But I also had a friend who I recommended to the counseling center, and he came back from it with not quite as great of an experience. He said that he didn't really feel like he was getting too much out of it. So I think it's individual basis, you know.
We should mention that we did reach out to Georgia Tech for participation in this segment, and we did receive no reply. Going back to Tim Elmore, president of Growing Leaders, what are some of the top things that college campuses can do to improve the quality of their mental health services, not just the quantity?
Well, that's a loaded question. You know that, don't you? But let me offer maybe two or three real quick thoughts. As we work in relationship with several thousand schools, I feel like as I observe, schools are far too often in a reactive mode. We're just trying to respond and react to the volume of students that are needing help. And I really feel like it's time now to be in a proactive mode. This issue's not going away. And my fear is that we just settle for a new normal. You know, well, kids are just depressed. Kids are just anxious. And I don't know that it has to be this way. So I would suggest perhaps revamping or expanding freshman orientation. I think the first-year student getting on the campus may have little idea what they're about to face. You know, they were the valedictorian on the high school campus, and now they're a bunch of other 4.0 students, and the pressure just feels so great. So in that freshman orientation, it's expanded. I think, as was mentioned already, there's a list of affordable outsourced counselors available. Maybe they talk to them about practicing emotional hygiene, like I mentioned before. And I think part of that needs to be social media training. If you look at the data, when this issue of high anxiety, high depression began to rise, it directly parallels the rise of social media. Now, I'm not a witch hunt here. I'm not finding a demon under every bush, but the overwhelming amount of data that you just take in when you're on social media is more than our brains can handle, I think, sometimes when we got a full load of classes and, you know, I've got this and that going on. So I think helping students really managing what's about to happen and that it will be very different than their past would really be, my term is we've got to help them practice good emotional hygiene, just like we practice good dental hygiene in
our
lives.
Yeah. And you're arguing that it's the job of more than just the counseling center on campus. It needs to be integrated into the curriculum, perhaps in other ways. I teach at Mercer University. One of the things that we do down here in Macon is, every single freshman student is required to do a freshman seminar class.
Yeah.
Where they meet once a week and we talk to them about common issues on campus. A lot of those are emotional and psychological. Colin Spencer, is there an equivalent at Georgia Tech?
We have GT1000 classes, which aren't required, but they basically are. Pretty much everyone takes them as an incoming freshman. But they're not usually integrated with issues, like you said. And that is something that we're actually working on. So.
Okay. What are your other top couple of agenda items for improving mental health services on the Tech campus in particular?
I think the major thing, Saturday, President Peterson announced that there's a $1 million endowment fund that he set aside for mental health resources. And so I think a lot of people right now are looking at suicide and the counseling center really as almost scapegoats for the issues of mental health, when everything really starts upstream of that. The counseling scenario is not necessarily the whole picture of the problem. 86% of people who do choose to complete suicide don't actually seek mental health resources. And so we need to have more discussions on campus about the culture of Georgia Tech. Why are people not seeking out these resources? Why does it seem almost natural for every year for us to have a suicide?
Well, good for you for getting that conversation going. That's Colin Spencer, External Relations Committee Chair for the Mental Health Student Coalition at Georgia Tech. We were also talking to Tim Elmore, President of Growing Leaders, which works to raise mental health awareness in young adults. Thank you both for being here.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, author Celeste Ng's latest novel takes us to a suburb gone wrong. But first, preserving history in Savannah. This is On Second Thought.
Rows of houses are burned down on me.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Among many questions, one question in the shooting of Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz is whether Officer Tyler Beck really needed to use lethal force to control the situation. Reveal News took an in-depth look at officer training in Georgia following another fatal shooting, the death of Derry Touchstone in 2015 in Arlington, Georgia.
We reviewed training records from every law enforcement officer in the state of Georgia. It's remarkable how little of their training is devoted to de-escalation. It accounted for about 1% of all the training hours over the last 5 years.
A Georgia University System spokesperson says that most of its campus officers are trained to deal with mentally ill suspects. They're trained with the GBI's crisis intervention training, though Beck, the officer in this particular incident, the shooting of Scout Schultz at the Georgia Tech campus, the officer Beck there was not trained. As recently as last year, the state of Georgia required no de-escalation training for officers at all. In February, the state mandated a new requirement. One hour of training. With me now is Derek Collins, CEO of the Diversion Center, which trains officers in de-escalation tactics. Hi, Derek.
Hello, how you doing?
Doing all right. Have you seen the video that shows the shooting of Scott Schultz?
Yes, I did.
Scott Schultz. Let me go ahead and just recap that for people who haven't seen it or haven't heard the details. Again, Scout Schultz, a student at Georgia Tech, calls 911 and reports a person waving a knife or potentially a gun on campus. And then, we have that phone call, that 911 phone call that Scout Schultz made. Let's listen to it.
Georgia Tech Police, how can I help you?
Hey, I'm over at West Village. It looks like there's somebody like skulking around outside. It looks like he's got a knife in his hand. I think he might have a gun on his hip.
Okay, West Village.
Looks like he might be drunk or something.
Give me a description of he, sir.
Long blonde hair, white t-shirt, jeans.
So after inviting police officers to the scene, Scout Schultz then apparently brandished what police were calling a knife. It turned out to be sort of a multi-tool that had a short little pocket knife attached to it. Scout Schultz walks toward an officer rather slowly, it looks like, from the video, shouting, "Shoot me, shoot me, shoot me." And eventually the officer obliges, shoots three times. Scout Schultz is dead. As you look at that video, Derek Collins, how do you think that the police handled it?
In my personal opinion, I think they could have handled it in a different way. They did not have to shoot Mr. Schultz. They could have not drawn their weapons, number one, and they need to recognize the difference between danger and fear.
Recognize the difference between danger and fear. Interesting. We'll come back to that. I'll just point out that Scout Schultz identified as gender non-binary and preferred the gender-neutral pronouns they, them. I'll, for myself, try to keep to that. So the difference between danger and fear, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is basically I could be afraid of a dog, and I do not have to kill this dog. But if a dog is attacking me, that's a dangerous situation. Therefore, I can protect myself and potentially kill the dog if it's trying to kill me. That's a dangerous situation.
Right.
Also, a fearful situation is someone who's scared of public speaking. Now, I don't have a chance of dying if I give a public speech, but if someone's trying to attempt to kill me while I'm giving a public speech, that is a dangerous situation.
But Scout Schultz could have theoretically killed an officer with that knife. This was a potentially deadly situation for the officer, was it not?
Not in my opinion. Think about this. Correctional officers de-escalate situations all the time and do not use deadly force. If you could do it in a prison facility, you can do it on the street as well. There's people with knives, weapons, and other means of harming an officer. And once again, also they had backup. In that situation from the video I watched, if it was me in the situation and someone is approaching me with a tool and I have three other officers around me backing me up and just walking towards me, I could back up, I could remove my weapon and try to talk to the gentleman and try to present myself as a friend instead of an enemy, because when we're going through a mental health crisis or a flight scenario, if someone's waving a gun at me, I'm going to be either run away or going to defend myself. And right. He wasn't, from what I understand, he probably wasn't mentally stable at the time of the incident. So therefore, I would approach it in a different manner.
Georgia Tech police have said that they don't carry tasers. Tasers were not available in a situation like this. They did have pepper spray. Is that an option that they might have reached for?
Absolutely. They should have definitely had tasers. They have also, there's other physical de-escalation tactics that they could have used and could have implemented. But if they don't receive this training, they wouldn't know how to implement it.
Well, like what? I mean, physically, how do you restrain a person who is brandishing a knife? Do you pull out your baton and try to knock the knife out of the hand? Is that something that you're trained to do?
There's some physical tools that they could use if they wanted to, just using their arms, their body, and it's hard for me to describe over the radio, but
sure.
There's some ways to do that. There's some like karate moves that they implement in de-escalation training to help subdue someone who is carrying a weapon.
Is the issue that, you know, most police officers in the United States carry a gun? That's not true in other countries, such as in the UK. When you carry a gun, is it sort of a, when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail sort of situation? When you have a gun, you're just more likely to default to using it.
Yes, you have to be careful with that, because I was told recently in a firearm training class that I took over the weekend that you do not pull out of your firearm unless you plan on using it, and that comes from a retired police officer.
Right.
And
do you think that's good advice?
In my opinion, yes. Every situation is not a dangerous situation. We have to know the difference between danger and fear, and sometimes, unfortunately, our officers don't know the difference between a dangerous situation and a fearful situation. They equate fear with danger, and we have to be careful of that.
That's Derek Collins, de-escalation trainer and CEO of the Diversion Center. Really appreciate your insights in this case, Derek. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kyler Brownville is one of Savannah's oldest African-American neighborhoods, and it earned its official historic status 2 decades ago. But since then, over 100 historic properties there have been demolished, including at least 8 neighborhood homes dating back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries. One group working to prevent more demolitions is the Historic Savannah Foundation. President and CEO Daniel Carey joins us now. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also with us by Skype is Amy Bragg, who is president of Preservation Detroit. Detroit, of course, a city that has had its own experiences with historic preservation, and in particular in historic African-American neighborhoods. We're going to compare some notes with Amy. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Daniel, just briefly tell us a little bit about this neighborhood in Savannah.
It's about a half square mile, bordered by MLK and Ogeechee Road and Victory Drive. And 37th Street. It's traditionally working class African Americans. A lot of them worked in the Central of Georgia Railroad shops up the way a little bit, and is a great representative neighborhood for vernacular architecture and just good, solid working class housing.
What kind of houses? I mean, describe things for us.
Well, as you pointed out, historically, they're late 19th, early 20th century, wood frame, very small, modest cottages, but a number of shotguns as well. And as you said, the area was listed in the National Register of Historic Places, and it has local designation as well, both important.
Sure. So does Savannah is obviously, you know, one of the great national success stories in historic preservation, and yet that success has not come without struggle, even in the most elite fancy neighborhoods of Savannah that were inhabited by very, very wealthy people, generally white people, slave-owning people. When we look at historic African-American neighborhoods, are there particular preservation challenges there?
I really don't think they're any different. There was plenty of blight in downtown Savannah back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the same in the Victorian District, same in Thomas Square. And that is what we're just really fully recognizing and addressing now in the late 20th century, early 21st century in Kyler Brownville. It's just taken a while to get there. But Kyler Brownville doesn't look that much different than downtown looked 50 years ago.
Amy Bragg with Preservation Detroit, how is what you're hearing about in Savannah compared to your experiences doing preservation in Detroit?
Well, it's a pretty similar set of challenges, although Detroit has, you know, unique historical reasons for struggling with some of the blight and demolition that we've seen in recent years. Detroit was hit very hard by the recession in 2009 and is still in many areas struggling to recover. We find that historic districts tended to weather that recession a little better. Property values tended to stay more stable in those neighborhoods, and the integrity of the buildings tended to hold up pretty well. But, you know, Detroit is still struggling with economic woes, and homeowners still find it difficult to maintain their properties in some cases. So that's true in both, you know, relatively well-to-do neighborhoods as well as it is in more economically depressed areas. So, you know, in the same vein, the city is working on a really massive blight removal campaign that's been underway for the past several years. The city is on track to demolish as many as 10,000 houses in the next 2 years. And that, you know, in the preservation community, there are concerns about that. Certainly, there are a number of blighted structures that are too far gone to save and present, you know, safety hazards and quality of life issues in neighborhoods. But that can also lead to kind of a massive demolition first strategy that, you know, we have concerns could lead to the loss of historic integrity that is really hard to bring back once you tear it down.
There can even be resistance among the residents of a neighborhood to having their neighborhood be designated officially historic. Tell us about this sort of landowner theory wherein historic designation is considered too costly for creating too much red tape.
Well, in Detroit, there are a few different places where this resistance comes from. There are neighborhoods in Detroit where the residents tend to be a little less well off. They worry about the cost of doing historically appropriate repairs to their buildings. You know, when you live in a historic district, you have to follow a certain set of standards about, you know, your window treatments or your roof or the colors that you paint your house. And people can, you know, they worry that that will lead to extra expenses for maintaining their property. You know, preservation has proven to have a long-term economic payoff. When you make an investment in the historic integrity of your neighborhood, your property values tend to stay stronger, and the quality of life in your neighborhood tends to be better. But for people who are struggling, that argument doesn't hold a lot of water in all cases. So there are individual neighborhoods in Detroit that have resisted historic designation or who are not interested in becoming historic neighborhoods. And personally, I think that's an okay choice. If your neighborhood gets together and says, you know what, we've looked at the pros and and cons. This isn't really right for where we are today. That's a choice that a neighborhood gets to make, and that's great. There are other ways to preserve buildings beyond that historic designation locally. You know, the other place that this comes from, which is a little more, I don't want to say nefarious, but is a little different set of interests, is on a statewide level, there has been resistance to the whole concept of local historic districts. Michigan was one of a few states a couple of years ago that was exploring the possibility of eliminating local historic district protection altogether. The theory being that, you know, property owners have unlimited rights to do whatever they want with the buildings that they own, and that historic district and other restrictive zoning codes get in the way of a property owner's right to do what they feel is appropriate to their building. So there was a statewide effort legislatively to eradicate historic district protection across the state. You know, that failed in committee, and we are staying vigilant. We don't expect that to come back to the Senate anytime soon, but it was a really serious threat to the whole existence of the historic district protocol in Michigan.
But going back to Daniel Carey, president of the Historic Savannah Foundation, this neighborhood that has occasioned this conversation, Kyler Brownsville, historic African American neighborhood in Savannah, this has been officially designated a historic neighborhood for quite some time, and yet there have been so many demolitions in recent years. So even getting historic designation is not a lock on the neighborhood actually being preserved in perpetuity, right?
That's right. It's not a single-handed panacea. It is a tool for revitalization, though, because there are incentives associated with being a historic neighborhood and having a property in the National Register. And those incentives are tax credits at the federal level, state level, and property tax abatement at the local level. And those are all intended to just level the playing field between demolition and rehabilitation. And we think that rehabilitation is a viable alternative to demolition, and those incentives can be used to facilitate that rehabilitation.
In the last 20 seconds that we have here, Daniel Carey, what more can be done to make sure that more of Kyler Brownsville survives?
It really requires political leadership from the city of Savannah. They've got to reduce crime over there. They've got to increase job opportunities, and then just not default to demolition when faced with difficult challenges.
That's Daniel Carey, president and CEO of the Historic Savannah Foundation. We also spoke with Amy Bragg, president of Preservation Detroit. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Just ahead, who is your real family? The one you're born with or the one that you choose? It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. And now we welcome another Celeste in the house. Author Celeste Ng published her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, in 2014. With its deft commentary on modern life, the book won several awards and was released in several languages. Ng's follow-up novel is Little Fires Everywhere, and it is out this month. The book follows a picture-perfect suburban family whose peace is threatened by an outsider. She will appear for a reading at SCAD Show in Atlanta tonight at 7 p.m. Now get ready to keep your Celestes straight. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with Celeste Ng earlier this month.
You know, this book is pretty firmly placed, and you keep reminding us, the reader, that it's during the time of the Clinton and Monica Lewinsky scandal. Why that era?
Well, the first reason was that was an era that I knew really well. I would have been in high school at the same time as the teenagers in the novel, and so that was an era that I could write about with a lot of familiarity, but also some distance and some perspective, I hope. But the second was that was an era that it's recent enough for us to remember, but it's far enough back that things were a little bit different. We didn't really have cell phones. The internet wasn't really a big presence. It was really still possible for people to hide secrets from their past in a way that it's much harder to do now. And so I wanted to set the book at a moment where characters such as the ones in the novel could maybe keep some parts of their lives a secret.
So was there a community that you knew well on which you based Shaker Heights?
There is. That Shaker Heights is actually a real community. It was my hometown from about age 10 until I went away to college, and it was a place that I loved and still love. It was a wonderful place to grow up. If you picture sort of suburban, nice houses, there's a tree on every lawn. It was really just a wonderful, wonderful place to spend my adolescence. And it was only after I moved away and was living on my own as an adult that I started to see, oh, a lot of things about this community are actually not typical at all, from the amount that it's planned to the layout of the streets and the amount of detail and attention that the city pays to every aspect of itself, to the attitude of the population. It's very progressive, it's very racially diverse, it's very activist. And I didn't realize that none of that was normal, so to speak, until I moved away.
So, I mean, for me, the book is really about parenthood, and in particular, motherhood and belonging, where one belongs in a family. And I'm going to ask you about that in just a moment. But I want to go back to Shaker Heights because the town itself is such a character in the book. And it's planned to the extent that in a certain way, it's problematic how planned it is. It seems to create this expectation of what a quote-unquote normal family looks like. And I wonder if that's something that you thought about as only as an adult, or it's something that occurred to you when you were growing up there.
It really only occurred to me as an adult. The motto of the community is "Some communities just happen; the best are planned." It was actually one of the first planned communities in the United States, and they really thought about what they wanted an ideal community to look like. This was their sort of plan for what, you know, a little utopia would be out in the suburbs of Cleveland. And when I was growing up, that just seemed like the world to me. The fact that, as I mentioned in the novel, you don't ever put your garbage on the front curb on garbage collection day because that makes the street look messy, and we don't want that. So you keep the garbage at the back of your house, and the city actually has a fleet of little golf cart-sized garbage trucks that drive down each person's driveway, pick up the garbage in the back, and bring it out to the big garbage truck at the front. So the street never looks messy. That's so metaphorically rich to me, that you have to keep so much of the unpleasant messiness of life hidden. That really wasn't something that seemed odd to me. I never thought about it until I moved away and people said, wait, explain your garbage situation to me again.
But, you know, I wanted to read one passage in here where this is Caroline talking about her childhood. And it says, Caroline grew up picnicking by the Shaker Lakes in the summer, skating on city-flooded rinks in the winter, caroling at Christmas. She saw matinees of Song of the South and Anna and the King of Siam at the cinema at Shaker Square. And on special occasions, such as her birthday, her father took her to Stouffer's restaurant for a lobster luncheon. As a teenager, Caroline became the drum majorette for the school's marching band, went parking down by the canoe club with the boy who would become her husband a few years later. The part I want to pull out of that is that Shaker Heights, at least the one in your book, thinks of itself as being extremely progressive, and in many ways it is. But there's also a sort of a bubble quality to the kind of liberal progressiveness there. And I feel like that is a good example, that paragraph, because what she thinks of as seeing diverse movies is Song of the South and Anna and the King of the Siam. Both of those movies are pretty problematic.
Absolutely. And that was the sort of tension that I wanted to capture in this novel, that it's a community that is very racially progressive and it is quite racially integrated, and yet it still has all of these blind spots. And it was so fascinating to me. And I live right now in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which I think has a lot in common with Shaker Heights. We think of ourselves as being sort of exemplars. We're trying to, you know, be role models. And yet, of course, we have all these blind spots. There are all these things where we think we're being so progressive, and actually maybe we're not as progressive as we thought we were.
And this comes up, I don't want any spoilers, but I think it's fair to say that one of the biggest issues, not the biggest, but one of them, is the fight over the baby, whose name is either Mirabelle or Mei Ling.
Right, depending on which side of the case you know your loyalties lie, exactly.
Right, either she belongs to the young, poor Chinese girl who gave birth to her and had to give her up when she was at a rough time, or she belongs with the perfect Shaker Heights
husband and wife who can basically give her everything that she wants. And the attitudes toward where this baby belongs sort of unlocks everything else in the novel, people's ideas of belonging. That's what causes kind of everything else. Why? Why the issue of a baby?
Well, I started off really with the idea of the community, and I started with the family, the Richardsons that live there, and then the mother and daughter who come in and kind of stir things up a little. And as I began to write about these two families, sort of thinking where they were going to come into conflict, the idea that this adoption question, this real question of where someone, a child, deserves to live, what kind of life they should be having, really encapsulated all of the aspects of the community and of this family conflict that I wanted to bring up. As you said, it brings up issues of class, it brings up issues of belongingness, it brings up issues of identity and race, of course. It seemed to bring all of that to a head. And one of the big ironies of the book, I think, is that even though this baby, Mei Ling, or Mirabelle, is at the center of this discussion, she's the only one who really doesn't get a voice in it. She's a baby, so she literally can't speak, but she also doesn't really have any say in what happens to her. Everyone is trying to decide what's best for her, and that was something that I wanted to explore.
Yeah, and there's this really interesting moment where two characters are having an argument about it, and one of them says, do you think if Mei Ling were grown up, she would make any choice other than to be with her own mother? And the other character basically doesn't answer that. There's no answer for that. And that's kind of, that comes up in other ways. One of Mrs. Richardson's daughters is faced with the same thing. She is empowered to start to think about that very question. Where do I belong? Where do I want to belong? How did you come to that? Was there a period of your life when you felt you didn't belong somewhere? Is that where this sort of, it seems to me, a pretty deep understanding of outsider status on your part?
Well, I think I spent a lot of my life feeling a little bit like an outsider. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the suburbs, and my family was the only Asian family that I knew. I was the only Asian kid in the school, and I was one of only two white kids in the school. And so I had this feeling always of being a little bit outside of the norm, or a little different from everyone else. Even in Shaker Heights, which, as I said, is pretty racially integrated in terms of black and white, there were very few Asians of any kind. And so again there, I felt a little bit removed from the discussions about race and sort of the understanding of how we look at race in America. And so when it came to this question of sort of, you know, where do you choose to belong, I wanted to look at the difference between the mothers that we get born to, who we obviously have ties to biology and maybe of the way that they raise us, and then the sort of mother figures that we choose for ourselves. A lot of times I think that we have the experience of finding someone who understands us better than our own mother in some ways. And there's a little bit of internal conflict there where you go, well, this person isn't my mother, and yet she's giving me something that my mother isn't able to give me for whatever reason. That's a little bit what happens with the daughters in this book. They've all got their mothers, and then they're also picking other mothers who draw them for some reason.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Celeste Ng. Her new novel is Little Fires Everywhere. There's another thread, right? I mean, there's many threads, but there's another thread running through here of generosity. And I say that because at one point, Mrs. Richardson, who's very well off, she's the landlord for these two outsiders, this mother who's an artist and her pretty eclectic, independent daughter. Mrs. Richardson is their landlord, and she decides she wants to do something nice for this other woman. And so she hires her to be her maid, basically. Okay, now this is complicated for me and really interesting, because in the end, the only reason the other woman becomes her maid is out of a feeling of generosity towards Mrs. Richardson. It's like Mrs. Richardson thinks she's being generous, but in the end, it's actually the other woman's empathy for her that allows her to do this. What were you trying to get at with this idea of charity?
Well, I have family members who have sort of worked in different kinds of service, food service and so on. I have friends who have. I was a terrible waitress when I was in college. But I've been really interested in the idea of, as you said, this idea of who's doing who a favor. It's very easy to think if you are the employer that you're being generous. You know, oh, well, I'm hiring you to do this sort of work. And if you're looking at it from the other perspective, you're maybe the one who's doing all the work if you've been the one who's been hired. And the idea of who is helping who and who's being generous to who, that is a big part of the dynamic between these two women and these two mothers.
And it comes up later because Mrs. Richardson is, I don't think she's nearly as generous as she thinks she is. She keeps tally of every nice thing she does for everybody.
Exactly, and it comes up, and it's one of those things that I think people do without realizing that they're doing it. You know, they do something because they think, well, this is a good thing to do. And yet later on, they realize maybe that they expect some kind of payback. And I think in some ways that's human nature. It's very rare to encounter sort of a true act of philanthropy with no strings attached whatsoever. And I think she's fooling herself a little bit by thinking that she's just doing this out of the goodness of her heart.
So you end the book, and again, no spoilers, but you end the book without answering a bunch of questions, which I totally understand from the perspective of this is what I'm writing for the reader. But I wonder if you yourself know what happens to them. Did you make that decision?
I have very rough ideas about what happened to the characters, again, without giving too much away. I have sort of ideas about how these characters are going to grow up and live their lives and what kinds of people they're going to become. And I hope, without, again, giving too much away, that these characters will have been really shaped by the events of the book, that this book will be sort of a turning point for them, and that their lives afterwards will be very different from having had these encounters and these experiences.
It's hard not to. I mean, the book begins with their house, the Richardson's house, being burnt to the ground. That's not a spoiler. That happens immediately. And we pretty much know who did it almost immediately. And then the question sort of is, why?
Exactly. I didn't want to pull punches. I didn't want to, you know, make the reader wonder, is something big going to happen? I wanted to let them know, yes, something big is going to happen, so that your attention can be focused on how did you get to this point? And I think really this is the story about hopefully how these families will sort of change each other.
So what has this journey been like for you, for a relatively new author who's seen incredible success even with your very first novel, which is not just a tribute to your skill and your talent, but also, wow, that's really, I mean, you had the whole conglomeration of luck combined with talent and skill in writing the right book at the right time, right? So how has that been?
It's been very surreal. It's, as you said, I mean, you know, I think I wrote a good book, but that's not the only thing that leads you to success. You know, there are so many good books out there, and there's so much luck, and there's so much help from other people and hard work and, I don't know, you know, unicorn dust that goes into, you know, a book doing well. I'm really grateful that the book has found its audience, but I still sometimes have a hard time believing that actually happens. You know, every time someone tells me that they've read my book, I'm a little bit surprised that they've found my book. And, you know, that's actually really humbling to me because I sort of like, oh, you know, you read this? Thank you. Thank you so much for reading it.
Is it a blessing or curse to have so much success with your very first novel? Does that make it easier or harder to write the second one?
It's both. I mean, I certainly would never complain about it and don't mean to complain about it. The way that I try to look at it is that I feel like I've now got a lot of readers sort of in my corner who are willing to, you know, follow me into another world. And it puts pressure on me because I don't want to disappoint them. But at the same time, it also makes me feel like they're there sort of cheering me on and saying, okay, go for it. Try something and we'll at least give it a try.
So you have a son of your own?
I do, yes.
Would you ever move back to Shaker Heights?
It's an interesting question because a number of my high school classmates have moved back and to raise their families. I don't think I will because we're pretty settled where we are in Cambridge. And a lot of the things that I love about Shaker Heights, sort of the diversity and the sort of cultural spirit that the town embodies, we have here. There is a part of me that always wants to go back. I don't know if it's just nostalgia for the hometown or if it is about Shaker Heights in particular, but it's sort of the ideal in my mind that I measure all the places that I live against, and so that temptation maybe will always be there.
That's Celeste Ng, author of the new novel Little Fires Everywhere. She will appear for a reading at SCAD Show in Atlanta tonight at 7 p.m. And that's it for our show today. But we always love to hear from you. Earlier this hour, we talked about mental health of young adults, particularly on college campuses. So you tell us, what solutions have worked for you or for the young people in your life when it comes to managing depression or anxiety? Give us a call at 404-500-9457 and leave a message, or post to our Facebook and Twitter pages. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea, in this week for Celeste Headley. Y'all have a great day.